From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, on this Labor Day weekend, a look back at 50 years ago, a labor fight, a strike, and a legendary march for better wages, improved working conditions, and human dignity for farm workers. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On June 1, 1966, farm workers in Starr County in the Rio Grande Valley, virtually all of them Latino, left the melon fields. They did the unimaginable. They went on strike. They were demanding better wages, $1.25 an hour, improved working conditions, including clean drinking water. The strike was met by derision, disrespect, and violence. They were told they didn't even have the right to strike and act as a collective bargaining force. But the workers continued and began a 490-mile march from Rio Grande City to Austin to bring attention to their cause. Along the way, the marchers were attacked and ridiculed, and when they reached New Braunfels, they were met by Governor John Connally, and instead of joining in their efforts, he told them to turn around and go back to the fields of the valley. On Monday, September 5, 1966, Labor Day, the marchers reached their destination, the State Capitol building. There they were met by thousands of supporters, now aware of their plight and their fight. 50 years later, on Labor Day, a celebration and remembrance of this historic march will be held in downtown San Antonio at Milam Park. To learn more about this march and its historic context and its legacy today, I sat down with Rebecca Flores, the chair of the Labor Day March celebration, and United Methodist Church retired Bishop Yoel Martinez, who participated in the march and supported the strike in 1966. What were the conditions at the time that led to the strike?
The state of Texas had a long history of labor issues, particularly with farm workers, low pay, deplorable working conditions, child labor violations. And particularly in the Rio Grande Valley, many of those farm workers were working for 40 cents an hour, no toilets in the fields. Very difficult for their families, for their children, and many of them had to leave the valley and leave South Texas to work in the Midwest, in California, in Colorado. And so when these workers came to a point where they felt that there was no future in what they were doing, and decided to walk out of those fields, I thought that that was a moment that the church and people of conscience, people that were working for civil rights and a new future, we needed to get off the sidewalk, as Dolores Huerta would say, and get into the march.
They were treated totally without respect and with no dignity. Even though, as you know, they worked hard from sunup to sundown in the heat of South Texas, and yet they were always mistreated in terms of there was no respect for the for farm workers. When I was a farm worker in South Texas, in that same period, it was like we were just like a subclass of people where nobody regarded the work that we did as having any kind of respect or any kind of merit, even though we knew and everybody knows that without that work, you wouldn't eat 3, 4, or 5 times a day. And so, yeah, there was all kinds of mistreatment. But apart from that, there was all kinds of stealing of wages. People wouldn't, their hours wouldn't be counted. Their wages wouldn't be paid. I remember when I first started working in South Texas, and even when my father was working in the fields, they would deduct Social Security from their paychecks or from their pay, and that Social Security amount would never get reimbursed into Social Security. And therefore, when some farm worker would get of age, he would go file for Social Security, and there was nothing in his account. I remember when I was working in San Juan, elderly farm workers would come to me and says, I've worked all of my life. I have paid all the Social Security. And they would show me their little envelopes where Social Security had been deducted. And he says, so I go to Social Security to claim my check. and there was nothing in my account. And so, yes, there was stealing of people's wages all along and during that period.
Rebecca, how old were you when you started working in the fields?
Oh, I was very young. I was 5 years old. I'm from Atascosa County, which is just south of here. Well, what I was doing then, and we worked as a family, which is what happens with migrants, right? You work as a family. My first memory was I was planting strawberries in Atascosa County. And what we would do is we would all of my sisters and I would get in a row, and one would make the hole for the strawberry plant. I would throw the strawberry next to it, and then my mother would cover it. And so there was three of us in a row. And I remember vividly because I was holding all these strawberry plants in my arms, and they had ants on them. And so I was covered with ants in a minute. And that's really what is the memory of my working. And I was little. I was little at that time. Oh, it's common, absolutely common. All of us were working in the fields.
And what did you think your future held for you? You were with your family working in the fields. Were you thinking, this is it?
You know what? And that is exactly right. I never had a thought in my mind that anything would be any different. That this was our core. This was our course. This was our due in life. That and as we grew up and we continued working in the fields, we just all the lack of field sanitation, the lack of drinking water. We thought, well, this is the way it is, right? We used to work in the cotton fields here in Pearsall, as a matter of fact. And we'd go with a crew leader, and he would haul out a bucket of water that had green fungus in it. We would drink out of a common drinking cup. It was a tin can, and we all did that. We just said, well, you know, that's the way things are for us, and we just had to live with it, and which is what we did.
But that is not the story. Something happened. Something changed your story, your future.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was just talking to a farm worker from Rio Grande City who's going to be up here for the Labor Day event. And he was telling me the same thing. It kind of reminded me of what we went through. He says, I used to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to go work in the fields in the summertime. In the hot sun, he says, I'm still really angry about that. He says, and so when the huelga came, quote, unquote, I fell in love with the huelga. He says, because finally, he said, we were going to do something about it.
But what did it take? I mean, you were there. You were there for the march. What did it finally take to get people to say, no more, we've endured enough?
I think what happened in the valley and through the march was that people saw an alternative future. They didn't have to settle for what generations of their families had to settle for. For instance, I was born and raised in Seguin, just down the street here from San Antonio. I picked cotton in East Bernard. I picked cotton in Seguin. I picked cotton in Corpus Christi. I chopped cotton in West Texas, all of that from ages 7 to 15. My family was not a farm worker family. My dad had a permanent job, but all the children in my neighborhood were farm worker families and farm worker children. So they would leave school in early May and return in early November. So they were, the educational opportunity was being denied. All of that, I saw that growing up, didn't understand the cost and what that future was going to be like for these children. So I think what happened in that moment is that people were awakened to the possibility of a new future, and they had allies in the church, they had allies in the labor movement, they had allies in the community with people of conscience. And when they saw those allies stand up, I think they said, we have people going with us, we're going to do the march, we're going to finish it and build a new future. So I think it was that it was a Kairos moment, as we say in the church, for a new beginning.
Rebecca Flores, can you talk a little bit about the role that law enforcement played in trying to prevent the strike and the march?
I think the history of Texas and farmworkers has been long in terms of the Texas Rangers. being called in to bust up any kind of labor organizing effort. It goes back to Yukapawa, when Yukapawa, which is a labor union, it was called the United Cannery and Packing Workers Association, started organizing in the 30s with Dominga Solis Sager, who actually was from here, from San Antonio. She told me, you know, before she passed away many years ago, that she had been organizing the cotton pickers and the onion pickers in Harlingen and in South Texas. And they had developed a group of members, and then one day the Texas Rangers came in and busted up their union hall, scared everybody, and so they kind of discontinued their organizing effort. And so the Rangers have historically been used by employers, by the ag producers in the state, to bust up any kind of organizing effort. When the farm workers in Rio Grande City started their strike on June the 1st, the Rangers were called in. They were there already. On June the 1st, they were already present and called in by the ag, the growers in South Texas. And so on the very first day, the leader of the lead organizer of the union was arrested, and he was put in jail, and he was fined. And so that is the beginning of a series of harassment of the workers until the season ended. The next year, when the workers started the strike again in the cantaloupe industry, the harassment, the arrests, the beatings continued at a greater and greater level. So much so that at the end of the strike, there was a lawsuit filed by Pancho Medrano, who was with United Auto Workers and who was an ally, and a number of other people who had been struck and arrested by the Rangers. They filed a lawsuit against one of the Rangers. His name was Captain A.Y. Ali. And this court lawsuit went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, finally decided in 1974, way long after the strike was over, that the U.S. Supreme Court decided that, yes, the Texas Rangers had been abusing their power and breaking the constitutional rights that should have protected the farm workers and the workers in organizing, the rights to assemble and the rights to speak.
And the beatings and the arrest, it was men, women as well?
Absolutely. I was looking at the arrest, the numbers of folks who were arrested, and of the total number, one-third of them were women. And so they were arresting everybody. Anybody, and there were the laws that were in place in the state of Texas were abusive language, which, you know, was thrown out eventually because you can't, you know, what's abusive language, right? I think somebody said a cuss word. The picketing law, which was you had to be picketing 50 feet apart from each other, and that was thrown out because that was unconstitutional in terms of rights of assembly. And there was a five laws that were thrown out because of the abuse that the law enforcement, not only Rangers, but law enforcement in general, were using to break the strike. There was one sheriff's deputy who was distributing newspapers for the growers. And it was just these little things that our taxpaying money, the taxpaying money of the folks there in Rio Grande City themselves, right, were paying in so that they could be used by law enforcement against them. And so yes, they used law enforcement at every level, the state Texas Rangers, the local sheriff's deputies, the prosecutor, who was also the attorney for one of the sheds there, the justice of the peace. They were all in lockstep working against the strike and the workers.
Frequently the growers during the strike would turn to laborers from Mexico and bring them across to break the strike. The striking workers, farm workers, tried to block the bridge in Roma, Texas, and that became a massive point of conflict.
It did. But apart from that, the workers from this side had met with CTM, which is the Confederación de Trabajadores Mexicanos, and had an agreement with them that they would not let workers come across from Mexico into Roma to be picked up by the buses that would pick them up there and then take them to the fields. And so there was an agreement at some point, but then at some point that didn't work any longer. And so workers, and so the growers were going into Mexico and picking up the workers and bringing them across. And so they were employed specifically to scab. They were employed specifically by the growers, La Casita Farms being the major one, to come in and break the strike that the workers were doing. And so one morning early, the striking workers from Roma and Rio Grande City decided to block the bridge. And they blocked it to a certain degree. 14 of the men were arrested and hauled off to jail. And then I think two or three women who weren't thrown in, weren't arrested at that moment, decided they were going to lay across the bridge on the, I believe it was on the U.S. side, and to stop the trucks and the buses from rolling through. And then they were summarily arrested and put in jail.
This is Texas Matters, and we're talking about the March for Farm Workers' Rights from the Rio Grande Valley to the steps of the state capitol that concluded on Labor Day 1966. I'm speaking with labor organizer Rebecca Flores and retired Bishop of the United Methodist Church, Joel Martinez. How do we decide that, okay, let's march? Bishop?
I attended a gathering in San Juan in late June of 66, where the Bishop of Brownsville invited Cesar Chavez to address the strikers from Rio Grande, and a lot of other civic and student groups were present, some clergy. And after that address by Mr. Chavez, which was very encouraging, very strong words, there was a gathering in one of the halls there at the Shrine in San Juan, and the conversation was how to keep this matter before the public, and particularly in other parts of the state.
And because the Rio Grande Valley is so isolated, even today, and even at that time, before satellite communications and the internet, right. It might as well have been in another country.
And the newspapers, frankly, and the media, at least the commercial media, were really controlled by the people in power and the interests that did not favor the working poor. So the discussion there among the workers, students, the priests, the pastors was a march, which had been talked about, is a way to go. And I recall one of the priests, I think from San Antonio, raised the question, if you start marching from the valley to Austin, you need to make sure that you have the resources, the support, that you have the commitment of the workers to go all the way to Austin, because the worst thing you can do is to start the march and then have to turn back after 50 miles because you ran out of money, support, and so forth. So where the church and the church leaders who were there supported the march and the workers, the commitment of the marchers was obviously the deciding point. But I want to say that those of us who made the commitment there and many others had to raise money and food and clothing for the families of the workers that were not going to be earning a salary or earning, from their work. And so they had to be supported. And so caravans of food supplies, clothing, financial support began to flow to the valley from a number of religious groups, student groups in the universities. And so that was part of what I was involved with, along with other pastors in this area.
And so, Rebecca Flores, you were a young girl working in the fields at the time. Did you know about this? Did you know that such an uprising was happening that was impacting your life?
No, absolutely did not. In 66, I was 23, and I was working. I was working here in San Antonio. And I remember when they came through. I remember when John Connally stopped them in New Braunfels, because it was on TV.
And he was the governor at the time.
He was governor at the time. And, of course, you remember that he stopped them and said, don't go any farther. I'm not going to be in the Capitol on the day you arrive. And besides that, I'm not going to support your cause to raise the minimum wage in Texas.
Right, and he was with Ben Barnes, the lieutenant governor, and also the attorney general at the time.
Wagner Carr. And so there's a wonderful photo of that confrontation there. And so when the news hit San Antonio, I remember watching it on TV with my father. My father was a farm worker all of his life. And we were totally, my father was so angry at John Connally. And, in that period, John Connally had been shot, with our President Kennedy.
During the assassination.
And so we held him in high esteem because, you know, he'd gone through all of that and we had a lot of respect for him. But after that, I remember my father just being so angry with Connally about his disrespect of people who had walked all that way by just saying, you know, go on back. I'm not doing anything for you. And from that point on, of course, we had nothing but disparaging remarks about John Connally.
But the marchers did not turn around. They continued all the way to Austin. When they did get there, what was their reception, Bishop?
Well, they were warmly received, as I said, by the leadership of the church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church. They were received at St. Edward's University, housed there, and there were some rallies in support of them prior to the march on Labor Day of 66. Some of the political leadership were very supportive, particularly Ralph Yarborough, who was a senior senator from the state of Texas, and other political leadership. What I do remember is that the students at the University of Texas, students at some of the other universities were raising funds and organizing support, as were some of the church leadership.
It's not easy to motivate that many people and keep them enthused about a cause, especially when they're dealing with the law enforcement that's trying to break their spirit, and also other psyops that are trying to tell them that their efforts are pointless and that they should better off go back to their families and go back to their lives. Can you talk about how Teatro Campesino may have played a role in teaching people about the movement?
You know what it did is it gave us language. It gave us a way to respond and to react to things that were happening to us. Like I said, we just thought this was our life, right? And we never had any right to say anything, to say, hey, why don't I get toilets here? You know, we never had the language to say, shouldn't we have toilets here? Shouldn't we get paid a better wage? Because we didn't know anything else. And I think when Mr. Carrera said to me, I fell in love with La Huelga, that was the other part of it, is that all of a sudden, we had a model to follow by the example of Cesar Chavez. And that's also very important, is that here was a man who looked like us, Juan Dolores Huerta, who looked like us and who was saying, hey, you know what? We don't have to put up with this kind of stuff. Look at what's happening in other industries and why aren't we treated the same? So it was a whole mix of different kinds of leadership, of modeling, I think, that came through with Teatro Campesino, but with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Dolores Huerta, very key player, because what she modeled for us women was that women also had a key role in making these changes. And like I said before, one-third of all the people who were arrested in Rio Grande City in 1966 were female. Now, I'm a Mexicana. I was raised in a certain way, very modest and very conservative in what I should do and what I should not do. And I'll tell you this, anybody who would break that mold was really breaking the mold. And so these women who were arrested, for goodness sakes, who were thrown in jail, for goodness sakes, in 1966, you talk about a different kind of role model for us. And I think that's what we began to see with Dolores, with Cesar. They were saying, you know what, we're not doing anything wrong. This whole area of the civil disobedience, we were not breaking anything that was immoral. We just said that some laws were not legal for, as far as we were concerned, and therefore we had a right to break those laws, and we did.
So, Bishop, talk about why it's important to remember the strike and the march today.
Yeah. I've always been concerned that as citizens of the nation, that we do everything we can, whether we're in religious ministry or whether we're in labor work or whether we're in banking or whether we're in public radio, that we conduct ourselves in such a way that we exemplify the meaning of our national creeds. And they're enshrined in our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, particularly in the Bill of Rights. And that's where we stand together as citizens under, if you will, those flags and those banners. And when we deny those opportunities and those rights to anyone, we threaten the future of the democratic experiment here. We live in a time where there's a tattered democracy, where only some benefit from it, and the whole of the people do not enjoy those rights. And at that moment, I think the church and people that have that responsibility have to side with those who work to redeem the promise of those creeds. Now, let me say one more thing. When Rebecca was talking about Dolores Huerta, I always refer to Dolores as the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. Whenever I speak about Cesar, I always say the UFW was co-founded by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. But let me say that Dolores said one fine day, somewhere in a little town in California, to a group of people who were standing on the sidewalk as they were trying to organize a march to Sacramento. And Dolores said the following, "Don't be a marshmallow. Get off the sidewalk. March with us into history." A woman, a Mexicana, a mother of many children. And that is what I remember about the farm worker movement, that it really has to do with getting off the sidewalk and walking with dignity, with courage, and with sacrifice into God's future. And so I just celebrate, and what it means for us today is we've got to do the same thing that Dolores asked us to do 50 years ago.
What I hear from a lot of people is, what can I do? What can one person do? What can I do to change things? Because we're all obviously aware that there's things here that we need to change. But I think the big example and why we commemorate this historic event is that the most humble people in this state of Texas, maybe in the country, took it upon themselves to take huge risks. They risked their employment. They risked putting food on their table. If you remember, in the 60s, there was no food stamps. There was very little public assistance. They took a leap of faith that when they took that leap, somebody would catch them. And so what happened was that we learned from them. And let me just remind everyone that a lot of the folks who were organizing in the fields in that year, who were allies in that strike, became leaders afterwards. They learned a lot of things, and I think they got inspired by those folks, by those farm workers, to do things to change the status quo that we were under in that period. Ernie Cortez, who's from here, from San Antonio, he became leader, national, maybe international leader of the interfaith networks. We have a number of other folks who became political leaders in this state, and on and on and on. And so there was an inspiration. What I think young people have to realize is that things don't just happen, that we have to take a lead and we have to jump in with both feet and make the changes that we want to see.
This Monday at San Antonio's Milam Park is a celebration and remembrance of the march from the fields of the Rio Grande Valley to the steps of the state capitol. The march and the strike were historic measures to bring better pay and humane working conditions to the farm workers of Texas and laid the groundwork for political organizations that would fight for Mexican-American civil rights and political clout. I was speaking with Rebecca Flores, a labor organizer and retired bishop from the United Methodist Church, Yoel Martinez. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write on our show page at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.